Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is June 27th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, Who Put All These Holes in the Ground? Presented by Rick Dunning. Number DUW2005-01. Let's listen in.
Started. Josh, you can start the CD. My name is Rick Dunning. I'm the curator of Holden's Museum, and also a teacher of geology the rest of the year. So I'll be offering several sessions related to the mine history and also the natural history of this area during the week. And the theme for the summer has to do with standing on holy ground, and this is certainly ground with a lot of holes in it. In fact, if it didn't have all these holes in it, there wouldn't be a Holden Village. So this afternoon I'd like to talk a little bit about the Holden Mine, give you a little bit of a historical background, if you will. Got quite a few images of what the mine was like when it was operating, what the community was like in those days. I just want to, kind of as quickly as possible, tell you the story of the mine. We can be pretty informal about this. If you've got questions as we're going along, please don't hesitate to ask. We'll see how we do. The story begins in 1887. In that year, the Great Northern Railway was looking for a route to the Pacific Ocean. One of the routes they considered was to bring their tracks up Lake Chelan and then up this valley, and maybe tunnel on through and get to Seattle that way. Well, if you've walked around the valley, you know they picked a different route. There's no railroad here, never has been a railroad here, but the name Railroad Creek sticks from that 1887 survey by the Great Northern. Now, the rail surveyors are interested not just in where to lay the tracks, but also what kind of land the rail company would get in exchange for building their rail line. That's the part of their deal with the federal government. So they make note of farmland and forest land and mineral resources along these potential routes. And their report on the Railroad Creek Valley described the presence of reddish-colored rock in many places. Now, this is a spot along the Holden Lake Trail, kind of up the side of Martin Bridge a little bit, but this is some of that reddish-colored rock. When we see it, it's an indication the rocks are mineralized, that there would be metallic minerals mixed in. The red color comes from iron that's present in the rock that's rusting, but there would be other minerals as well. And that would be a natural place for any kind of prospector to start looking. And this reddish rock occurs in many places around the Railroad Creek Valley. There were already prospectors working in the Lake Chelan area by the late 1800s. And this report by the Great Northern stirred up a little more interest in the region. Of course, the prospector we're interested in is a man named James Henry Holden. That's who the mine and the town are named after. Now, Holden was born in the East, but his family moved to Iowa, and then as a young man, made his way west trying to seek his fortune. He mined a while in Colorado and went broke. Mined a while in Nevada and went broke. Sort of the old miner story, always looking for another grub stake, hoping to strike that mother lode somewhere along the way. Well, he ended up in the Seattle area, and he hooked up with a prominent Seattle family, the Denny family. Anybody here from Seattle? You know the Denny name, of course. Many things around the Seattle area. Well, Holden worked on the Denny family ranch a while and became friends with one of the Denny's sons, Victor Denny. And in 1892, the Denny family decided they would take their summer vacation on Lake Chelan, just like some Seattle families do today. And they spent a couple weeks boating and camping up and down the lakeshore. Holden came with them, and that was his first introduction to this area. They came back in 1893 and did the same thing, interested in what the prospects might be in terms of mining possibilities and other business interests. In 1896, Holden and Victor Denny came back to prospect, and they chose the Railroad Creek Valley as the place they were going to prospect. Now, right away that summer, Victor Denning was called home to look after one of the family's other operations. And that left Holden all by himself here in the Railroad Creek Valley. And he worked his way up the valley, wasn't having a lot of success. One day he was up on Martin Ridge, looked over at Copper Mountain, saw an interesting ledge of rock. Went over to Copper Mountain, but he couldn't find it. Gradually, his supply started to run out. One day, he was hunting up on the side of Copper Mountain, shot a deer, and the deer landed dead on that ledge of rock. That's how we discovered the ore body. Now, of course, you take a story like that with a grain of salt. Lots of mines have stories like that, but that is the way the Holden family tells it. Now, Holden spent the rest of that summer digging samples out to have assayed, and at the end of the summer went to file his mining claims. Funny thing was, when he filed the mining claims, he forgot all about the Denny family. Forgot about his grubstakers. He only filed the claims in his name, which in mining law makes them his claims, but you can imagine the Denny family wasn't very thrilled with that. In fact, later when they found out what a good ore body it was, what a good mine it was, they took Holden all the way to the state Supreme Court trying to win back what they thought was their half of the mine. But the court said there wasn't enough documentation to establish a business partnership. So Holden went to work the next summer, but the one thing Holden didn't have was capital. And when he aced out the Denny family, he got rid of his source of cash. So you can't start a mine without money. And Holden didn't have any. So Holden literally spent the rest of his life trying to sell this mine. And ultimately made a pretty good living off the mine without ever mining here. Built himself a little cabin, his family came up with him, he hired a few extra miners. Most of the way that Holden made money was by leasing this claim to bigger mining companies that were interested in buying it. There were people that, when they heard about the claim, certainly thought it might be a good one.
It, going back to when he discovered it, could he see metal, or was it just ore type thing?
When you're up close to the face of that rock ledge, you can see the shine of the metallic minerals in it.
Right, okay.
So, when a bigger company was interested in leasing this claim, or buying this claim, they would lease it first. And that way they had the chance to look around, and if they liked what they saw, they could buy it. So between 1900 and the First World War, Holden leased this claim to several big mining companies. The other way he made money was to sell stock, formed his own company, and paid himself a wage as the company president out of the stock proceeds. Now, Holden was quite a promoter. He spent a lot of his time, as I say, trying to sell this mine, and he went all around the country, and he produced literature showing the beauty of the area. I think this is supposed to represent Lake Chelan, but who knows where that hotel ever was. Nothing like that on Lake Chelan, but he had all kinds of schemes to try and promote this mine. Slow. Eventually married a local rancher's daughter. They had a lovely house in Chelan. Became prominent citizens of the community. Played in the local band. This was the music room in the house. Raised four sons in Chelan. As I said, they made a good living off the mine, even though they never mined here. Now those companies that leased the claim from Holden did some work up here. They would pack in equipment like this, and they'd start some development work. They started to build a railroad bed up from Lake Chelan, because that's how they figured they'd have to get the ore out. So part of the road we drive on started out as a railroad bed, at least that was what it was intended for. They built a mining camp up on the mountainside called Honeymoon Heights. This is a shot of what the Honeymoon Heights camp was like. Holden's original cabin was in that same area. In fact, you can still see the remnants of it up in Honeymoon Heights. But the companies that leased from Holden built a bigger camp there. So Holden made a pretty good living off the mine. Ultimately, none of these companies decided to purchase the mine. It's too expensive to build that railroad to get the ore out. So when the last of the leases ran out, Holden had to borrow some money from a man in Chelan that had struck it big in the California lottery. Man's name was Crooker Perry. Holden was going to use that money to hire more miners, to dig more samples, to again show off to prospective buyers. Now, Holden died suddenly of cancer in 1918 without paying off this debt to Crooker Perry. So Crooker Perry took the widow Holden to court to force her to pay the debt. The only way she could pay the debt was to sell the mine. So in 1921, the mine went up for public auction at an auction on the steps of the Wenatchee Courthouse. On the day of the auction, Crooker Perry showed up and bought the mine. He already had some of his money invested. He bought the whole thing. Paid about $21,000 for this mine. But from 1921 on, then the Holden family's out of the picture. Their name sticks, but they had nothing to do with actually operating this mine. But Crooker Perry wasn't a miner, and he didn't have enough capital to open a mine up here. So he was really in the same position as Holden, trying to sell this claim. But by then, all of Holden's work had paid off, because people knew about this ore body. They knew it was a good mine. And by the 1920s, truck technology had developed to the point where you didn't have to build the railroad anymore. You had an alternate way to get the ore out of the valley. So in 1928, Crooker Perry leased this claim and then right away sold it to a company that had been mining in Canada. Now, their original mine is on the coast of British Columbia, north of the city of Vancouver, on what's called the Howe Sound. And so when they incorporated in the U.S., they called themselves the Howe Sound Mining Company. That's the company that ran the Holden Mine. They came in 1928 to start planning out the mine with engineers and geologists. But of course, the stock market crash and the depression came along, so they closed down their operation for a while. They came back in 1936, finished the planning work, and in 1937 essentially built everything we see here. The town, they built the switchbacks down to the lake, they built the mill building on the other side of the valley, they dug their tunnel into the mountain. By the spring of 1938, they shipped their first concentrate down lake. They mined from 1938 to 1957, so we could figure about a 20-year life for this mine. In that 20-year period, they took out almost $100 million of precious metals. About 70% was copper, that was their primary product, 20% gold, the rest silver and zinc. Now, once you get a chance to go back outside, maybe walk up the road a little bit, as we look at Copper Mountain, when Holden found this ledge of rock, it's up pretty high on the side of Copper Mountain, way up there. But when Howe Sound geologists came in, they discovered it's in a layer of rock that runs vertically across the front of the mountainside. So Holden's original tunnels are up here. But Howe Sound decided they could come in lower on the mountainside. So their tunnel is right about there. Doesn't show up very well on this picture, sorry. But their tunnel goes straight into the mountain, half a mile. And then they hit that vertical layer of rock. From there, they started mining upward. So when it started, it was an unusual mine. Instead of starting from the top and going down, they started from the bottom and went up. But that was a great advantage because as they mined out the ore, it was falling down toward their tunnel. Gravity was helping them out. But they got all the ore above that tunnel by about 1945. And then they started to follow that layer of rock downward. It's more expensive then because you got to haul the ore up before you can take it out. But from top to bottom, the mine is over half a mile. So the bottom of the mine is several hundred feet below Railroad Creek. From side to side, the mine is about half a mile. And that layer of rock is about 80 feet thick. So it's a vertical, typical vertical underground mine, except you go in the middle instead of the top.
Have you ever been in there?
I have had a chance. It's spectacular. Really, really fun. And I'll show you some pictures of what it's like, at least when they were mining it. They worked on 14 different levels. So inside that mountain are over 50 miles of tunnel.
Yeah. So Rick, you're saying that the mine is over a half a mile from top to bottom,
yep,
over a half a mile wide, and 80 feet deep.
80 feet thick. Yep, that layer. Yep. Exactly right.
That's a huge hole in that mountain.
Yeah, where they take that ore out, they leave big cavities behind. In that 80-foot thick layer, they blast most of that out of there. So inside this mountain are artificial caves. The miners call them stopes. Some of the stopes are so big, you could have a couple football fields end to end. They're literally underground dome stadiums inside that mountain. But the rock is so hard, most of the rock of this mountain is harder than steel. So there's very little danger of that caving in. Some of the biggest rooms are up near the top. And so if anything's going to cave in, it might be those larger rooms up high.
How large is the largest room?
It is 900 feet long and 600 feet high.
And 80 feet deep.
And 80 feet wide, yeah. So it's pretty amazing.
None of this stuff is shored up particularly?
Not too much. We'll see some of the tunnels in a second here. I'm going to switch to the second half of the program. Give me just a second here. But the rock is so hard, they didn't have to do much timbering in there. Now, of course, Lake Chelan plays a pretty important role in terms of a transportation link. You got this remote, isolated mine. This is important to getting it out and getting it out inexpensively. And of course, up here, you've got to think about snowfall, because the average snowfall is close to 300 inches here in the valley. So if you're going to operate a mine year-round, you've got to deal with a lot of white stuff. These buildings were clustered up around the mine entrance, up in the area that today we call the third level. All of those buildings are now gone. So this is the mine portal, the main entrance, and we'll just go right in. We'll take a tour of the mine. At least photographically. You can still find that portal structure up on the third level today. Yeah, that's a little out of order, sorry. All right, so when the miners went underground, they climbed into these little box cars, and the train drove them in through the main tunnel back half a mile into the mountain. And then they climbed in the shaft, the vertical elevator, and went up or down from there. Of course, everybody had a hard hat on underground, but your real ticket to get into the mine was a headlamp. Now, he's got his in his hand at the moment, but he'll put it up on the front of his helmet pretty quick. Every miner had a metal tag with his number on it. So when you start your shift, you turn in your tag and they give you a headlamp. And when you come out of the mountain, you turn your headlamp in and they take your tag off the board. When all the tags are off the board, they know everybody's out of the mountain. That's part of their safety system. And they did their bigger blasting between shifts or on Sundays when people weren't underground. So we'll just follow back through the main tunnel. The entrance of the mine went through glacial sediments, loose material, so that had to be timbered. And after the mine closed, those timbers eventually rotted and caved in. So the opening of the mine had caved in. But when you're about 100 feet in, then it's just bare rock wall from then on back. And they didn't have to do much in the way of timbering.
So what was in all those pipes?
Well, they had one piping system to pump water out of the mine, because there's always water filtering in through it, through the rocks. And then they also had a pipe to pump compressed air into the mine to run the drilling equipment. They had the compressors outside. Now, here's the little locomotive that pulled the train, just a little electric train, runs on overhead power like a trolley car. Here you can see the headlamp on his helmet. Here's the battery pack down around his belt. They had some battery-powered trains for remote parts of the mine. But everything was mechanized about what they're doing. This was a state-of-the-art operation. In fact, people came from around the world to visit the Holden Mine because it was so modernized. So half a mile in, you get to the vertical shaft. It goes up or down. You climb into the elevator or the lift, and that takes you to the level that you're working on. This is the hoist room and the big winches that raise and lower that elevator. Yeah, question.
How do you get oxygen in there?
There was a ventilation fan, another tunnel opening up the valley from the main tunnel, and a giant 8-foot fan pulling fresh air through the mountain. Although they didn't really have trouble with gases or problems like that, but dust and smoke would certainly be an issue.
Would the fan pull through the system or push air into the system? Into the
it was
tunnel?
Pulling it down from above.
So pulling air out and through.
Yep. Yep. Exactly right.
Kind of like a big exhaust fan.
Yep. Hoist operator, the whole system ran on bell signals, so you'd climb in the elevator and you'd ring the bell a certain number of times. That would tell the hoist operator where to raise or lower the car. Now this is a simplified view of the mine. In fact, the upper part is so oversimplified, we'll just ignore it. But the lower part's a pretty good representation of what the mine looked like vertically. About every 150 feet or so is a tunnel that goes over to the ore layer. So you blast the rock out of the ore, drop it down a chute, it's lifted up to the main tunnel, taken out of the mountain for processing in the mill building. And we'll talk about the mill a little bit later. This is one of those tunnels going back toward the ore body. And remember, it's half a mile wide, so it splits out along the width of the ore body. And you can have several crews working in different places at the same time. The first crew we enter, the drillers. And it's their job to drill holes in the rock. So their equipment basically is braced on some kind of post system. And this drill is essentially a jackhammer. It runs on compressed air. You know what jackhammers sound like, so just imagine that in a closed tunnel. But it's pounding a hole into the rock. And then when he finishes one hole, he just tilts it a little bit, drills another one, and he just keeps angling the drill different directions. And from that one setup, he can drill a whole series of holes. It might take a week or two to drill enough holes to get this done. The rock is very hard, so they've got to change bits a lot. Or as the hole gets deeper, they've got to put in longer bits. Then the next crew in are the powder men. And it's their job to slide sticks of dynamite up into those holes, pack them in there, set the fuses to the right length, cut them so that they blast in the right order. The middle holes blast first, and then the outer holes after that. Then once everything's set, it's ultimately their job to light the fuses and get out of the way. Those were the high-paid jobs underground. Now, when they're tunneling, they just blast a little bit at a time. But when they're working in that ore body, they're trying to break as much rock as possible. And they don't have to worry about cave-ins because the rock is so hard, so they use lots of dynamite. Some of their explosions, they might have 100 cases of dynamite in a single blast. And just the explosion would be part of the crushing operation. It would help to pulverize the rock so it was small enough to get out of there. The next crew in are called the muckers. It's the job of the muckers to scoop up all that broken rock. So here's a couple of muckers sitting on their next week's work. Of course, they didn't have to do it by hand. Here's a little bit of muck at the end of a tunnel. When they're tunneling, they just go a little bit at a time because they want it under control. But the muckers had several pieces of equipment to help them. One is a big drag bucket on a winch, so that would scoop the ore toward them. And then they had several kinds of little front-end loader-type machines, and they could scoop up that broken rock and put it into the ore cars. Now, this is what the ore cars looked like. As I say, they don't really have to do much handwork in spite of what the picture suggests here. And the ore cars dump sideways, so they would go out and dump their load down that chute that we looked at in the diagram. It's lifted up the main tunnel in this big square bucket, or up the main shaft in this big square bucket called a skip. And then loaded into ore cars again to be hauled out of the mountain over to the mill.
If they had rocks too big to put in the car, could they re-blast them?
Yeah, they'd slap a little dynamite underneath them and break them up. Yeah, that's right.
Are all the ore cars the same size, the ones below and the ones that they're hauling out of the mine?
Yeah, pretty consistent. Now, we talked about the stopes, the big cavities left behind. Here's an example of one. And here's a person standing here for scale. I'll give you a sense of how big it is. And this is one of the smaller stopes. Some of them are much bigger than this. Now, to build these stopes, they got to start at the bottom. They got to build a tunnel at the bottom first. And then they tunnel up beside the ore body and into it, plant those big loads of dynamite, and then it blasts downward. And then they scoop all that ore out and they tunnel up a little higher, plant some more dynamite, and blast it downward again. So the stopes grow upward, higher and higher, till they just coalesce with the next level. This is another picture of a stope, but there's nobody standing there, so we don't get that same sense of scale. They've got a lunchroom underground, so here's some miners midway through their shift taking the lunch break. The mine went 3 shifts a day, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. So they were always going. Another shot in the lunchroom. I want you to note the date on the chalkboard. The mine closed July 1st, 1957. Most of these shots are just within the last couple months of the mine's operation. This is a look straight down the vertical shaft, over 1,000 feet straight down. That had to be heavily timbered because you don't want rocks breaking loose and falling down the shaft onto the elevator.
How big are those timbers?
Oh, they're at least 12 by 12. There were some smaller ventilation tunnels to help that airflow through the mine, connecting different parts of it. And when you're underground, there's a lot of pressure on the rock. And in a tunnel, sometimes pieces of rock will just blast off, break off the top of the tunnel just because of the pressure. And so somebody patrols the tunnels and they pry loose rocks off the ceiling so they don't come off unexpectedly. So here's the train pulling the ore out of the mountain. And then it goes over into the mill. So this is the building that used to sit across the valley from us. We just see the bare wreckage of it today. The train would come across this little trestle here, right into the top of the mill, and dump their load of ore in a big bin at the top of the mill building. And then it just starts down through the crushing machines. And again, gravity's helping them. It's going down the hillside as they work through this. The first machine was called a jaw crusher, with big steel jaws that go back and forth like that and break the ore down to about 1 1/4 inch size. The next machine is called a cone crusher, kind of a mortar and pestle type action, rotating. And that breaks it down to about 1/4 inch size. The last crusher is a machine called a ball mill. It's just a big rotating steel drum full of steel balls that bounce around inside. And that breaks it into powder. All of the rock of the mountain had to be ground up into about the size of talcum powder. Fine, fine grain material. Finer than the sand in the middle of this fire pit. Once it was ground up, it went into what were called flotation tanks. Big tanks of water, 10 feet deep, with air bubbling up through them. And they'd add some pine oil to create bubbles, and then the chemicals they used to extract the valuable minerals were called xanthates. X-A-N-T-H-A-T-A-E-S or something like that.
xanthates. They're engineered organic chemicals, and they're designed to stick to valuable minerals and make those float to the top. So the good stuff skims off the top of the tank. It's sort of like a special soap that only washes valuable dirt. Sticks to it and makes it float. All the waste rock stays at the bottom of the tank. Then it goes into another tank. Same thing. Goes through a sequence of six different flotation tanks so they can try and get every bit of valuable stuff out of there that they can. What they're doing really is concentrating the ore, not purifying it. You don't get pure metal at the end. You just get a concentrated ore. Now, this ore at the Holden mine is called a low-grade ore. It's only about 2% valuable metal and 98% worthless rock. So you can't dig it out of the ground and ship it off down lake because your transportation costs are based on weight. And that's why the mill was built here, to take that raw ore and concentrate it from 2% to maybe 35, 40% valuable metal. And then that's what they shipped out. In a ton of rock, you'd get about 40 pounds of copper, maybe 5 pounds of zinc, a third of an ounce of silver, a tenth of an ounce of gold per ton. So you got to crush a lot of rock to make $100 million in the 40s and 50s. This mill could process 2,000 tons of rock a day. Again, working three shifts a day.
What powered the mill?
Everything ran on electricity. But they used so much electricity that they had to get it from Chelan. So there were actually power lines up the shore of Lake Chelan, across the lake, and up the Railroad Creek Valley to provide the power for the Holden mine. This is just a summertime shot of the mill. So what came out the bottom was the concentrate, and we'll see that in how it was transported in just a moment here. The worthless rock, the waste rock, the tailings, or what we call the waste material, was coming out of the flotation tanks as a slurry of rock and water mixed together. So they piped it down the valley to make the tailings piles, which are the big orange piles that we see when we drive into the village. This is what's left over when the good stuff is taken out. All of this ground up rock went through the mill for that separation process. Now, to build these tailings piles, they'd construct a dike and just sluice that tailings material in behind the dike in kind of a settling pond. The rock would settle out, the water would drain off. When one pond filled up, they'd just build another dike on top of the first one, and they'd build it higher and higher or start expanding it down the valley. Until today, those tailings cover over 90 acres of the valley bottom. That's our visible evidence of what they took out of the mountain, are those piles of tailings.
So did that runoff pollute the creek?
It did, yes, and still does. And I'll have a program on Thursday about pollution problems related to the mine.
Yeah. Did they get everything out of the mountain?
No, probably not. There's still ore at the bottom of the mountain, at least as far as their test drilling was able to ascertain. Now, in 1957, the price of copper dropped from 47 cents a pound to 24 cents a pound. That killed their profit margin. They just had to turn it off and walk away because they weren't going to make a profit at it anymore.
The one thing you had said in a previous year is that what really fueled the mine was World War II?
Yes. Yep. The copper and the zinc were strategic metals. So the government bought most of their production at a set price. And miners who worked here were exempt from the draft because it was considered a strategic industry. Those government prices kind of continued in through the 40s and early 50s. But once those stopped and once some foreign sources started to open up, like the Chilean mines, that's when the price of copper dropped.
Was it as hard on the miners, the ingestion of the dust and stuff, as like coal mining is?
Not quite the same way. This rock, if it were just dust and you breathe it in, it would cause you health problems. Mm-hmm. silicosis is a different lung disease than black lung, but from the rock dust. But the way they tried to counteract that was to keep it wet and keep the dust down by keeping it wet. Gentleman on the right here was one of the truck drivers in the mining days, and that's the next set of slides. These were the trucks that they drove the concentrated ore down to the lake with. They're a little dark here, but on the back of each truck are three steel buckets of concentrate. Each bucket held 5 tons of concentrated ore. So they drove down those switchbacks with 15 tons on the back of the truck.
You can also see the chains on the
back. Yep, you got chains on the back. Of course, they got to pay attention to those brake systems. They got to keep the road open all year to make sure the trucks can get up and down in the wintertime. Their dock was about the same position as the modern day dock is, but it's a different structure. At the end of the dock was a big crane that could lift those heavy buckets off the trucks and place them then on a barge, and the tugboat would tow the barge down to Chelan. So again, each bucket had 5 tons of ore in it. Once it got to Chelan, they took the buckets and put them on trucks again and drove just a short distance down to the Columbia River below Chelan where the railroad was. And there they could dump it into train cars. It went by rail to the city of Tacoma, Washington, where the smelter was. And smelting is the last purification stage of processing the ore. In the hot furnace of a smelter, different metals melt at different temperatures. So you'd then melt out the pure metals in the smelter operation. That's a quick look at how the mine worked. Now, questions?
Did you say, am I remembering correctly, that you talked about like a 55-gallon drum of water on the back of the trucks to keep the brakes cool?
They did have bins or buckets of water to cool the brakes, yes. And one of the accidents, at least, was a driver that forgot to check the water level in the buckets. His brakes burned up halfway down.
What was the location of the smelter in Tacoma? Where in town was it?
I never remember seeing it in its position. It was the Asarco smelter.
Ruston, right on the water by Point Pines.
Ruston?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's gone now. Although there are some environmental problems still remaining from its operation. That smelter processed a lot of ore from all around the West, not just the Holden ore. But all the ore from here went there. Other questions about the mining part? I want to show a few pictures of the community, but...
I just basically want to know how they secured that mine so that the public, so it's not dangerous for public to dig in.
Right now, any of the tunnels that were open at all have steel gates across the front that lock. And the main tunnel has a locking door on the front of it. All right, I would like to mention just a few things about the community in those days. This is the original Honeymoon Heights honeymoon couple. These are the Barquists. He was the lead engineer in 1928 and brought his then young bride with him as Howe Sound was just starting their planning work. Once the mine was up and running, there were a number of young couples that still liked the isolation of living up in Honeymoon Heights, and that's really where it got its name. And the Blys were one of those young Honeymoon Heights couples in the early years of the mine. Eventually, the avalanche danger and the blasting was so bad that the company made them move down. And John Bly became a shift boss, and they moved into one of the chalets in the background. The chalets were, in the mining days, houses for the management folks. So the big boss was in Chalet 1, and kind of as you went up the hill, that was sort of the company hierarchy. When you got a promotion, you're not... didn't just get a new job, you move down the hill to a different house. This is what the houses looked like in 1957. So, pretty much the same way they do now. The structures are the same, the village intentionally keeps them that way, and the Forest Service demands that we intentionally keep them that way. We've got more trees now, we've got more varieties of paint, but they are still the same basic structures. This is a look down Main Street, Route 57. Again, all the buildings are the ones that we see left over from the mining days. The one that's most been modified is the one that we're in right now. Koinonia was a dormitory, and the single miners lived in these dormitories, the lodges, where you're staying. They lived two to a room in the dorm and ate their meals in the dining hall. So Koinonia, one end was torn apart to make this fireside room, and a few of the original rooms, though they're heavily remodeled, are still left on the upper floor here. In the base of the lower level of Lodge 6 was the grocery store. It was a company town, so you didn't have much shopping opportunities here. There was, besides the grocery store, a dress shop and a beauty shop and a little barber shop, but that was about it. Most people sent down Lake.
So how many men and women?
Well, I think at its largest, the peak population was probably pushing 700. A typical shift would have about 100 miners underground, maybe 40 or so on the surface. And then you add some families into that mix and you have about 700.
But do you know how many were women and children then of that 700?
No, I don't. But we had 14 houses plus another 100 out in the miners' village. And those were family homes for the most part, so you can get a rough estimate at least of the spouses from that number. This was the inside of the rec hall, what we call the village center today. It was their social center. And it is kind of interesting, I think, that the mine would provide such a facility, but they understood that if you're going to have people living in an isolated place like this, they need a social life. And so they provided this facility. The gym, when it was built, was the largest gym in the state of Washington. They had dances, that's what we see here. They had sporting events. They had movies three times a week, including Saturday afternoon matinees for the kids. Of course, downstairs you had the bowling alley and the pool hall. Those were important parts of the recreation facilities. They had bowling leagues for men and women, juniors. They had poker game going in the back room. At least in the early years of the mine, they had slot machines. Those were outlawed in Washington in 1945. The whole facility was run by the community club, and they used all the proceeds from all these things to fund social events, parties and stuff. Of course, the biggest party of the year was the Christmas party. And every year at the Christmas party, Santa Claus would show up, and every kid in the village would get a present. Apparently, after 1945, the presents weren't quite as nice because they didn't have all those proceeds from the slot machines to work on. But they still got presents. This is a look at the area that today we call the miners' village, at least part of it. These are where the families lived. The married miners and their families had their individual homes here. That's just part of it. The miners would have known it as Winston or Winston Camp. Shows up a little better with the contrasting snowfall here. At its peak, over 100 homes in Winston. Kind of the Holden suburbs.
Those were rental properties for the people?
Each family owned their own home. They leased a lot from the Forest Service, but then they built their home or paid to have it built or bought it from somebody else if they moved in later. So they were, the homes themselves were private. This is a look at ground level, just to give you a sense of what some of the homes were like. And another shot at the point where you turn to cross the vehicle bridge. So that would be the view up the valley there at the corner of the miners' village.
Did they have cars up there?
A few folks had cars, not many, because you really didn't have anywhere to go.
Right.
But some had cars. It was difficult because in the wintertime, the roads had to be kept open for the trucks, and unless you had a garage, and hardly anyone had a garage, there wasn't any place to put your car. Give you a sense of the snow depth late in the winter. place to be a kid, just like it is now. There was a school here for kids from first grade to eighth grade. Once you got to high school, you had to go board somewhere else. At its peak, there were over 100 kids in the school by the time the mine closed. They'd gone from a one-room schoolhouse to ultimately a three-room schoolhouse. Our Narnia building is the Holden Schoolhouse from the mining days. There were lots of activities for the kids, campfire girls, Boy Scouts, school plays, sporting stuff, of course, games and adventures after school. There were social groups for the women, hospital auxiliary type organizations, sewing circles, birthday clubs. There were sporting activities for the men. It was pretty much a typical small town in the 40s and 50s, except that everybody was working for the same company. Of course, you knew everybody, and everybody was working together. Holden Village still hosts reunions for the mine families. Every other September, those that can make it up for this reunion. So a wonderful event, great time to hear stories of the mining days. Many of the families talk about their time here as the best years of their life. Small, close-knit community, isolated in a beautiful place, they have the same affection for the place that we do now. Here you see the sleds parked by the back door, ready to head off to school. They even had their own ski resort. Some of the engineers rigged up a rope tow on the side of Martin Ridge. They ski all day and end up at their back door, just like Aspen or Vail. Here's some of those private cars. Here they're parked at Lucerne for the wintertime. Again, because if they just left them here and the snow piled up on them, they would be in pretty sad shape. We park our buses down there in the wintertime for the same reason.
There's less snow down there.
Yeah. No, significantly less snow. There was a whole community of folks at Lucerne. Some of the miners lived there because there sometimes wasn't enough housing up here, so they would live down there, and there's a bus that went back and forth every day, so they would commute up to work. There was also a little resort. Folks would go down swimming, picnicking, that type of thing. There was a dance hall. And Lucerne did have one thing that Holden didn't have, and that was the tavern. Of course, you know, miners being miners, they're going to let off a little steam now and then. So that was one reason to have your own car. You could get down to Lucerne to go to the tavern. I need to see a big dog here.
Is any of that still remaining in this area?
A few of the boat club's structures are original from that time, but mostly not. As they say, the mine closed in 1957 when the price of copper dropped. The company tried to sell the mine, but if Howe Sound wasn't going to make a profit here, nobody else was either, with the price of metal the way it was. That's about the time that a man named Wes Preed started writing letters to the mining company, saying, here you've got this mine available, might make a good church camp or something like that. And he just kept writing. Meanwhile, the company was getting more and more desperate. They allowed a salvage company to come in and start tearing out metals and machinery, and that's why a lot of the buildings were wrecked. And finally, with his third letter, Wes got a phone call back saying that they were ready to donate the mine and the town. It was donated first to Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle, the school that Wes had been a student at. LBI fairly quickly figured out they didn't have the resources to be able to work with something like this, so Holden Village Incorporated was formed as an independent nonprofit organization, but drawing on all the Lutheran bodies. And that's the organization that still operates Holden Village today.
And it was formed when? 1950?
The Articles of Incorporation were 1960. The mine closed in 57. It sat vacant for about 4 years. The first volunteers came in 61 and started cleaning up. But the salvage company was already working at that time.
Well, this is a national forest area.
It is.
How how does that work? Is Holden Village part of the National Forest, or is it?
Well, we are sitting on land that we lease from the National Forest. The town site is leased under a special use permit. Holden Village technically owns the buildings, that those we got from the mining company, but the land the buildings sit on is leased on a 20-year renewable lease. Holden Village does own property in the valley because the patented mining claims on the side of Copper Mountain are private property, and they're Holden Village's private property. So we own the mine, we just don't own the town. It's an odd arrangement, certainly. Yeah, go ahead.
What was the safety record for the mine?
For the most part, it was pretty good. They ran a not just a state-of-the-art operation, but a fairly safe operation. There were no cave-ins, fires, explosions, anything like that. There certainly were injuries. There were some fatalities through the years. But overall, it was a very safe operation. Just wanted to point out, this is the wreckage of the area called the Assay Office, their chemical testing lab. This is the foundation the museum is built on. So if you haven't been to the museum, it sits up beside the old mill building because they needed to go out and sample the ore coming through the mill, but it's built on that original mine foundation. So we end with a little bit of a sunset over Bonanza Mountain. They're a wonderful set of images. It's nice to see what the place was like. Any more questions come to mind, having had a chance to see that? Yeah.
We won't be here on Thursday to hear your talk, so I've just got a couple of questions.
Sure.
If the material they used to separate the ore from the waste material was an engineered organic material, which you said it was, where is the toxicity coming out of the tailing piles? What's the source of the toxicity going into the river?
Okay. It's the ore itself. Ultimately, this particular ore is made of sulfide minerals. So the metals are mixed with sulfur, which means there's sulfur in the ground up rock of the tailings. As water infiltrates through that pile, the water and sulfur mix together and you get acidic water. That's part of the pollution problem. And then that acidic water can dissolve metals out of the pile.
Because of sulfuric acid?
It's a very mild sulfuric acid.
Okay.
So it dissolves some of the heavy metals out of the pile, and those also get into the creek. So the pollution source is really just the natural rock, but the fact that it's ground up and exposed to oxygen and moisture means there's much more of that stuff getting into the creek than there would be naturally.
Now, in the introduction, Janet showed us the video of the new bridge and all, and mentioned that there was some reclamation going to happen in a couple of years. Can
yes.
you briefly
well,
talk about that?
The Forest Service and some other state and federal agencies have been concerned about the water pollution problem here. And not only is it the tailings polluting Railroad Creek, but the mine itself is filled with water up, at least the lower half of the mine is full of water, and that water drains out of the mine, and it's been in contact with the ore, so that water is polluted also. And so they want to try and find some ways to cut down on the amount of polluted water getting into Railroad Creek. And the agencies are in the process now of trying to figure out what will be the best way to address those problems. So we don't really know what the next step will be, but it will be something to cut down on the water pollution issues.
Because Holden Village owns the mine and so forth, does Holden Village have any liability for the pollution?
They do, yes.
Even though they were not the cause of it.
Right. As a property owner, technically, they are named a potentially responsible party in the language of the legislation. But what Holden doesn't have in this case are deep pockets. And the kind of things that are needed in terms of addressing these pollution problems are likely to cost something in excess of $50 million. And you're not going to get that from Holden Village. So the federal government has pursued the mining company, except that Howe Sound doesn't exist anymore. They were bought out. But the company that bought them out or ended up with their assets down the line is the company that has been named as the responsible party. They've agreed already that they accept that responsibility. So they've got the deep pockets that will pay for this cleanup work. But Holden, yes, technically is partly responsible.
Do they reuse the chemicals that they use to separate them?
Not really, because those chemicals went out, typically adhered to the minerals. So they were burned up in the smelting operation primarily.
Are there any Holdens left in Chelan?
No, I don't think, although some of his wife's family, I think, is still in the area because they were local. I've only met Holden's granddaughter. Of the four sons are all passed away. I met one of the granddaughters when she came up for a visit, but I don't know of any Holdens in the area.
Do you know of any plan early on of what to do with the tailings when they designed the whole process? Or was that just neglected originally?
Well, no, they were pretty careful with how they dealt with the tailings, and they were under a fair amount of scrutiny. There were, even in the 30s, some local outdoor and sportsman type clubs that were keeping watch over things here and demanding that the tailings be handled in a certain way. So given the technology, the time, and the requirements of the mining law, they did what they were supposed to do. There's nothing irresponsible in terms of how they acted relative to what they were required to do at the time.
Do you know how mines are handled today to keep pollution from tailings from being so bad?
Well, a lot of our mining is still governed under the Mining Law of 1872, which technically doesn't require you to clean up after yourself. But most of our modern mining is done in surface mining, open pit mines. And there, because of what happened with the coal industry in Appalachia, there was enacted the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, which does govern open pit mining and require reclamation after you're done and monitoring for pollution problems. So a lot of our modern mining falls under that category of being controlled by that more recent legislation.
Now, several years ago, there was drilling done in the tailings by some scientists from the state and rocks put on. How has that helped?
It certainly has helped a lot. The tailings were covered with gravel in about 1990-91 and riprapped along their edge to protect them from erosion. Certainly reduced the dust problem. And it's helped the vegetation to get started on the surface, so that if you look at the tailings from above, they're not nearly as obnoxious as they used to be, the big orange pile. The sides are still orange because they're too steep to be able to cover. But the tops have been covered over and partially revegetated and look very different than they did a decade ago. But it hasn't solved the water problems, and that's what they're going to have to go back in and deal with. I do want to let you know about some other programming. I have an assistant working with me in the museum who happens to be a woman who grew up here in the mining days as a girl. And she will be providing some very interesting programming during the week. Tomorrow afternoon at 2, she's leading a walk down to the miners' village, since that's where she used to live. She'll talk about a much more personal perspective on what life was like here during the mining days. And so if you get a chance to attend her programs, Linda Jensen is her name, I certainly encourage you to, or at least catch up with her and chat a little bit. She's in the museum most days. I have a few more programs this week, one on glaciers tomorrow evening, and the mine pollution problems on Thursday. So I want to thank you for coming this afternoon. Thank you.